Have you ever wondered why exactly it is that things usually sound better at home than they do on stage, in auditions, or even in lessons? It's easy to chalk it up to nerves or assume that you just have to practice more or get more performance experience. And sure, those things certainly are part of the puzzle, but a lot of times that's not really the true root cause. If you've been confused by the inconsistency of your performances, I put together a free 4-minute quiz called the Mental Skills Audit, which will help you pinpoint your mental strengths and weaknesses and figure out what exactly to adjust and tweak in your preparation for more consistently optimal performances. You can take the Mental Skills Audit online at bulletproofmusician.com/MSA. That's MSA for Mental Skills Audit. And again, it's 100% free, and it'll take just 4 minutes to get your results emailed to you as a PDF. This is Noah Kageyama, and you're listening to the Bulletproof Musician Podcast. Every Sunday morning, we'll take a look at a new research-based tip or technique to help you practice more effectively or perform better under pressure. And on the first Sunday of every month, I'll have a guest from the music, sport, or research world who will share their insights on how we can all be a little more awesome in the practice room and on stage. Today, I'll be chatting with harpist Lynn Aspness. Lynn has had a distinguished career as performer, educator, and administrator, with numerous premier works on various labels, to faculty and leadership positions at the University of Michigan and Arizona State University, to her current role as president of the American Harp Society. In this month's conversation, you'll hear Lynn explain why a harpist's hands and arm movements are so important, not just from a technical perspective, but from a music-making and communication perspective. How singing can help with breathing more naturally as you play, how perfectionism led to a very public and very spectacular failure that changed how she prepared and how she worked with students, and much more. I wanted to start by asking you about this beautiful hands phrase that I often hear you use in regards to different harpists. I don't know if it's always the case, but it often seems to be like the first thing that comes up. It's like, oh, beautiful hands. And then you go on to talk about other things. But it sort of reminds me of how people talk in golf or tennis or in basketball sometimes about a beautiful looking stroke and so forth. Obviously, there's more to it than the aesthetics, I'm assuming. But yeah, I wonder if you could just say a little bit about what that is and what that means and why that's important.
I think the first thing is if you've heard me say that, and for example, maybe it's with a student that I haven't worked with before or someone who I've just watched play, I'm doing what I can to put them at ease. If they are moving around the harp fluidly, I'll say that because they kind of relax and go, okay, technically I'm going to be all right. And then instead of having to focus in their minds on, did I put my fingers in exactly the right places? We can come at that from another angle. But I thought about this, and I thought about it a lot, and I think the interesting thing for the harp is, like the piano and the organ, you have to remain so static when you play. This instrument is leaning on your body, and it's big. It's heavy, and so you don't have necessarily the same kind of ability to move with the phrase. And for me, way beyond the technical completion that is shown by a hand that moves fluidly, it's about the only place where the harpist can demonstrate aesthetically what's in their mind. So to me, a hand that finishes a phrase by coming away from the harp slowly or quickly sustains that note in the way that you would normally see someone, perhaps with a bow or with their instrument, you know, to raise the instrument up to give this sense of length. And I think when harpists do that and when the motions are integrated into their technique, it's really beautiful. And it means it's happening organically from their internal phrasing. I think we see a lot of musicians sometimes who simply move because somebody, they read in a book somewhere that they need to move when they play. But the movement isn't directly related to what's in their head musically. So, yeah, it's really fascinating to me when I see a harpist whose hands express what they are feeling the music is saying.
The bit you mentioned about the ending, and I don't even know if this is how harpists describe it, but it's not just the plucking of the strings, but it's also the follow through, it sounds like, is also really important, not just to communicate visually the musical ideas they have, but is there also kind of a technical function that's important about how you follow through with the strokes?
I do think there is, because it's how you set up the follow through that makes the sound. So in harp playing, the articulation is going to dictate your follow through. So if you see a musician, we can take a harpist. So if you go in for a note, because you're in contact with the strings for so little of the time that you're creating the note, how you come in, how you articulate, and how you leave actually affects the sound. Because you're either going to come in and really lightly just tap the string and come off, which is going to be a very dry, very short, very articulate sound. But if you go in and you press and you stay there and then you have a long follow through, what you've done is you've created a more sustained sound through the playing. And I do think that it's completely related to dancing and to breathing. It's how we breathe. We prepare, we execute, and then we follow through. And you can tell in young kids who are playing that they don't do it. They just put their hands on and they go, whoop, whoop. And they haven't really thought about what they want to have that sound like.
I was listening to an occupational therapist talk yesterday, actually, and she was talking about how, from an injury prevention perspective as well, I think it had something to do with rebound, right? So like at the end of the particular stroke, you don't want to be holding in tension, but you actually want to be releasing tension through the end of whatever movement you're making. And it sounds like that might relate as well to this idea of follow through.
Absolutely. And at the harp, we call it a gesture or a completion or something. And people have different approaches to how they create that gesture going in and then the execution and how it follows through. For me, gesture is the umbrella term, but there's so many nuances to how you do it. And it relates back to this idea of having a sound in mind before you play. Because it's true that if you just abruptly change what you're doing, whatever it is, you're putting stress on your muscles. If you prepare for what that muscle is going to do, you have a much better chance of a supple kind of follow through and longevity, a sustainable technique. And in this case, it translates to really terrific musicianship, I think.
This person was also talking about the benefits of videotaping, but without sound, right? So you videotape to look at what you're doing and not so much confuse yourself by hearing the sound. Because sometimes it can sound great, but not look great. And I don't mean aesthetically again. Is that something that's maybe particularly useful for harpists? Or maybe it's useful for musicians across the board and we just don't do it very much.
Yeah, I think we don't do it. I've never thought of that. It's a great idea to for myself to play something and not hear it. We almost always, don't we, record a practice session and then start listening and immediately forget about anything but the negative things we're hearing.
Right.
Yeah. And to do it without the sound, that would be great.
There are a couple of things actually that came up that I wanted to follow up on before I totally forget about them.
Oh, yeah.
When we were talking about hands, one had to do with breathing. The other one had to do with the sound in mind first. And maybe we'll get to that in a second. But with breathing, I think we think about breathing in the context of giving a cue, like in an ensemble or a chamber music situation. But at least personally, I would totally fumble everything if I actively started thinking about breathing. And I just couldn't figure out how to breathe and when to breathe and what to do. It would kind of throw everything off. But when you talked about breathing a second ago, it sounded like it ought to be a very organic thing that's tied into phrasing and to singing and to playing. How do you work on that? Like, how do you make it so that it's not something that then suddenly makes you start thinking about breathing and you can't remember how to do it or when to do it?
Well, first of all, I'm sure you wouldn't fumble anything. But secondly, I do think about that. And I think of it from the standpoint, for my instrument, of the fact that I don't have any way to sustain sound other than in my head. And so if I'm not singing it, if I'm not singing that phrase and actively shaping the phrase by taking a breath, or on a fermata, not taking a breath, maybe holding it and continuing without breathing, I'm not going to make phrases. I'm going to make bar lines. I'm just going to continually make bar lines. So from that standpoint, I'm breathing through phrases while I'm playing. Whereas I think, I don't know, would a string player be able to, their breathing could be at a different rate than their bow rate, and it would still, they would still be phrasing because the bow is taking care of it.
Yeah.
Is that possible?
Yeah. Yeah, certainly.
But a singer couldn't.
Right.
A singer has to be breathing for that phrase. Who was it who just recently passed away? Oh, a tenor. I think it was a tenor. 24, no, was it 24 seconds they went on a phrase? 24 or 34 seconds. And they played the recording clip of this. It was an elderly singer, so a generation or two ago. But you listen to it and you think, you know, you try holding your breath for that long, and that's a long time. And here this person just used it to spin out this phrase. It was just amazing. And for me, at the harp, it's the only way I think I can do it. The other thing is that I'm singing things away from the instrument all the time. So by the time I sit down to play them, you know, in any context, I'm already breathing where I think my phrases are. People can disagree, but that's, you know, they may put the phrase somewhere else, but that's kind of, don't you hum? You hum around the house. Hum, hum.
That's interesting. I was never a very vocal person. I have teachers who always told me to sing in lessons, and I was embarrassed, and I would sort of just go through the motions of doing it. Even though I actually took voice lessons as a kid, my aspiration was to be able to sing the Chipmunks Christmas song. That's all I wanted to be able to do. So that wasn't particularly helpful. But this is interesting. It's interesting because it makes me think that, so if you're humming around the house, if you're thinking vocally, I wonder if that means that you're actually thinking of phrases in vocally meaningful chunks. And then maybe it means that, not just does that affect phrasing, but maybe it means that your own breathing as you're playing, maybe naturally, just kind of goes with it.
Yeah, I think it's been a long time since I felt that I wasn't naturally breathing in the phrases that I wanted to play in my practicing. So yes, I would say that that's true. And I think that influence of just humming what you want to do, I'm not a trained singer in that sense. I did a lot of singing as a young person and all the way through school and things, but it's just having in my mind that I'm making long vocal lines, and that's kind of where it comes from for me. I should learn the Chipmunk song.
Well, it's interesting. Like, I'm just trying to sing the opening of the Tchaikovsky Concerto in my head now to see how it would change if I actually had to sing that, instead of thinking just sort of technically on the violin, how I would play it. And I think it would be different. And maybe this is maybe what like all my teachers were saying to me all those years and what they meant. And I'm just now getting it. So you've kind of set it up so that you've been doing the humming, you've been singing as you're practicing and thinking about it in those terms. When you're actually then playing it or performing it, are you then also singing in your head as you go, or are you thinking something different as you're playing?
I think it comes and goes. I know when I am really focused, I'm singing the phrasing. And I can tell when I drift out of that I'm sort of losing focus, so I try to kind of close that door and come back in. I may be singing the names of pedal changes, but I'm still singing something. Because I know that when I stop, that's when I go for myself into this kind of analytical brain. Okay, well, that note wasn't very haunted. What's the next thing? And I go, no, you got to come back to it. And so I try to start bringing it back into the playing. Hmm. That's almost always, too, where I find that I've been holding my breath and have stopped organically kind of breathing with the phrase.
So that might actually be a good place to transition into this other question about having the sound in mind first. So, you know, I was stalking you online and looking at videos of you, and there was one in which you were talking about how important it was to understand how to create a beautiful sound first and foremost, and then even from the very beginning, to train your ear first, perhaps, and to be able to really hear the sound that you want in your head, and then try to create it through the mechanism of the harp, which seems like it would be really important combined with the singing thing that you were just describing. How does one do that? I mean, how do you get there?
Oh, if I knew, I'd be some sort of teaching guru on a hill somewhere. Well, for me, the idea of integrating it early on is, I mean, I've thought about this too, and I think any creative person who has an image in their mind of what they're going to do, they don't know how it's going to turn out. They may choose a subject for a painting, or they may start with some paint on a canvas and then it leads them somewhere. But they have this sense in their brain that there's an image there. There's something happening. And it's, to me, it's just something as a teacher we have to tap into early on and find out what that is. For some people, it's going to be something they heard. For some, it's going to be visual. For others, it's going to be something they read that they're trying to recreate. If I can do an anecdotal story, there's this wonderful little program that Harvest participate in that's a kind of evaluation of their playing, where they come and they play a piece, and then 6 weeks later they come back and play it again and they get feedback. And one time I went and adjudicated a group of young players, and there was one 8-year-old, I think, and she was playing this piece called Moonlight. You know, and she came in and she sat down, and without her music, she hammered right through it. You know, it was great. She had all the notes and it was in rhythm, and it was... it was so analytical. She had just ticked off all the boxes and done everything. And so we talked a little bit, and I said, what do you see when you play this piece? And she just kind of stopped, and she didn't expect that. And I said, when you come back 6 weeks from now, would you paint me a picture of Moonlight? And so I went back 6 weeks later, and in came this girl just charged into the room, and she had not on an 8.5 by 11 inch piece of paper, but she opened up this huge piece of tag board that was folded in half, on which she had painted like a starry sky with a moon, and there was glitter in the stars, and there was the earth underneath. And then she sat down and played, and of course it was night and day, literally night and day from what she had done. And so she didn't have something that she heard, but she saw, given the chance to say, what do you see in this piece? She just, her imagination went wild, and it translated to a different sound on the harp, and she moved differently, and she kind of bent over the instrument, sort of drew out these round sounds, and then the little plinky stars came out, and I was astonished. That it was kind of that easy to just give her that chance to be that creative. So I think it can be a visual thing. I think it can be an aural thing. I think we just have to find a way to get context, or to help the students get all kinds of context for what they do. You know, try to say, you know, what did you have for lunch today? Or play this piece as if you're really frustrated with somebody. Play this piece as if you are just as happy as can be. And they begin to, even in that way, at the younger ages, they begin to bring in their experiences. And of course, the older they get, you want them to have aural context, not copying another harpist, but often understanding where the repertoire came from and the original, what it sounded like, what it was played on, or orchestrate your piece. You have a whole orchestra in front of you. Who's playing that part? Who's playing this part? Find those sounds. And that's what I mean about integrating the aural in the training. it isn't really oral skills or anything else. It's just getting into their heads that all these sounds are there. And how are they going to bring those out through their harp playing? Does that make sense?
Yeah. So it's not classroom type of work, or it's not anything formal. It's just having a target to shoot for,
yeah,
visually or orally.
Yeah. And I didn't come from a strong aural tradition of harp training or any other instrument. I was sat down with a book of music and forced to look at those notes and figure them out. And I wept and screamed and yelled and cried and got big stickers when I got it right. But I didn't start from a position of sing that song and then play it on the harp. And I think if I had, it just would have kicked in sooner, maybe. I don't know.
Can you say more about what you mean by kicked in? Like for me, you know, I was at it for 20 years before I felt like I finally got it. You know, all the things that my teachers have been trying to get me to finally grasp, and they were saying it over and over, and I never really heard them until finally I was like, oh, I think I get it now. I'm wondering if it's a similar thing, but can you tell me more what you mean by that?
You know, my training, my early training happened in an era when it was very much the student had the book and you worked through the book. And my mother was my teacher. So part of the frustration, I am positive, is that I wouldn't do what she wanted me to do. And so she stuck me on the bench and just said, you know, do this over and over again. And yet on the other side, you know, I sang in choir. We sang songs all the time. I listened to, my dad used to put on reel-to-reel tapes of musicals, and I would sing along with all these songs. Now, if those two sides, if somehow my mother had said, well, why don't you sit down and try to play Oh, What a Beautiful Morning, you know, without any music, or just hum it and then pick it out on the harp, I would have integrated those two sides earlier on. But I just think that for me, it took a knock on the head in undergrad from my voice teacher for me to realize that I wasn't singing when I played the harp. But I went to voice lessons and I sang, and I sang in choir and I sang my arias and did all that. Then I would go play the harp, kind of fast, kind of straight through, you know, and I wasn't, and he's the one who mentioned it. He said, you know, I've heard you do both and it's not the same thing. And it probably took, just like you, it took another couple of years, you know, the trickle down theory for me to realize that what he meant was that I wasn't breathing. I wasn't taking time in my instrumental music the way that I did in the vocal music. And I just wonder if I could have learned that earlier. I don't know. Maybe I wasn't ready to hear it, which could definitely be it. I bear some responsibility here. But I think when he said that, it really, it was like getting hit over the head a little bit. And then it took a few years to do what you said about integrating the breathing at the harp. I went and heard a great, really interesting duo the other night, a Celtic harpist and a folk dancer. They were doing things together, and it was a really interesting genre. But he could do the dance steps and talk while he was doing them. And so the Celtic harpist, who is absolutely adorable and terrific player, started to introduce a piece while she was playing, and then she stopped and she said, I can't do it. She said, I can sing and play. But she said, I thought because he could do that, I could just talk through this introduction. She said, I can't do it. And so she stopped, did the speaking, and then went back to playing. So I just think sometimes we have to try a lot and fail a lot until it becomes something that's natural. And I think as a teenager, I didn't want to fail, so I wasn't going to try.
So it seems like you had a number of influences earlier on that didn't really kind of come together until later. Yeah. Do you feel like that is kind of how it played out, that eventually they converged at a later point, even though they seemed separate or unrelated at first? Or because I'm sort of fascinated by this story of Pete Sampras that I read in Andre Agassi's book about how Sampras was not a very remarkable junior player because he was looking to the future and changing his game, which meant making lots of short-term sacrifices in terms of wins and losses. But all of a sudden, I think when he was like 18 or 19, he won the US Open, and they all kind of came together and converged all at one point. I guess I'm just curious about having more fun or being immersed in technique and how those things kind of balanced out.
I like your optimism that they balance out. That's really nice. You know, I think it's really interesting. I've been thinking about this a lot, and I have always thought about it in the context of my own career and my playing, because when we're growing up, I think we're in the environment we're in, and we work within that environment. And we may not step back when we're 14 or 15 or 16 and say, what's my contribution to this environment? But from a distance, I can look back on my teenage years and realize that I was so stubborn that no matter what my mother, who was still my teacher all the way through undergrad, no matter what she said, I wasn't going to do it. So maybe she wanted me to take space in my playing. I don't know. But if she said black, I had to be white. And if she said the sky is yellow, I'd say, no, it's pink. I wasn't going to do what she said. Poor thing. I don't exactly know why she kept me when I think about it now. But I do know that for me, the outside influences were all vocal influences. So ultimately, I think it's like making a big pot of really savory stew or something that you can put it on the back of the stove and you keep adding ingredients. And at some point, they all blend. And I think it just that took longer for me than I think for some people, because I was stubborn and I might not have been paying attention and doing what was being asked of me. So I take some responsibility for that. I don't know if that's what you're thinking, but technically I got what I needed to move around the instrument. But musically, it all came from other places.
Do you think your mom was pleased about that? Or do you think it stressed her out that you weren't getting enough harp influences?
You know, I think it was just the way it was, Noah. When I was growing up, we lived in the Midwest, and there were not a lot of harpists, and there weren't a lot of, I mean, my dad had recordings. He was crazy, crazy LP man, and he would record things on tape off the air. He loved music, and he would go down to work after dinner to the basement. He would turn the radio on or the broadcast or whatever was on. And when he heard something he liked, he would just hit the reel-to-reel tape recorder and he'd record it. And then he'd come running up the stairs and say, you got to listen to this, or you've got to hear this, or, you know, I pulled this off the air. And it made us all a little nuts. But I think the assimilation effect has been overwhelming for me. And that's really where it came from. And I think harpists are in a unique position because we don't get the span of music stylistically in our repertoire. There were no real solo works for the harp until the early 19th century. The 18th century works are all adapted from keyboard pieces. There's some, but they're treating the harp as just another keyboard instrument at that point, which it was. It hadn't evolved into what it was. So we have no Beethoven. We have one Mozart concerto, which was written under duress and is not good, you know, because Mozart was just, he didn't want to do it. So he just tossed it off and he never got paid for it, I don't think. We have no original Bach. We have a sonata by C.P.E. Bach. We have one. Whereas you think about these other instruments and they have volumes of music. And orchestral music. We have nothing until 1828, until the Berlioz Symphony Fantastique. So a harpist doesn't learn her musical context by being a harpist. You can only get that, I think, by playing viola in your high school orchestra, you know, or doing something where you're in the repertoire a lot more than you are as a harpist. And for me, it wasn't that, it was singing. And so I think that made the difference. And it was my father bounding up the stairs with recordings and say, hey, listen to this.
That makes me think of people downloading stuff from YouTube nowadays. That's like the early version of doing
it
that.
It is. It was totally. It was the 1960s version of YouTube. It was my dad coming up the stairs. You won't believe what I just heard on the air. And he did something else for me that was, again, the equivalent of what you not the equivalent, but parallel to what you said about videotaping yourself and just watching yourself play. When it came time for me to work on some of the big repertoire, he would make me a tape of five different performances, but he wouldn't say who they were. It drove me mad because all I wanted was to be told who I should listen to and how I should play it. Just tell me who's right and I'll do that. And he would say, listen to these and tell me what's different, what you like, why. And it made me crazy, but I would do it because I was competitive enough that I wanted to play something really well. And it was his way of taking away those, the hierarchy of who it was or where they were or what country they were from or whether they were playing with a good orchestra or maybe not the greatest orchestra in the world. And it was just listen to this and tell me what you think. And I wonder how many people had that option in their training of this parent who would just say, there are lots of ways to think about this. Here are five. Take a listen and see what you think.
Do you have any insights on how he picked them? Like, did he purposely pick varying approaches to it or
he would.
Some that were, yeah, I'm curious as to what his thinking was behind the selections he made.
Well, he collected music, as I've said, from all these different sources. So, for example, I remember the one that he made for me of the Debussy dances, where he consciously picked an Italian harpist, a French harpist, an American harpist, and somebody I didn't know they were young, but it was something he'd pulled off the air, a live broadcast, and I can't remember the fifth one. But he did intentionally try to put in things that varied in some way based on their background. Ironically, many of the performances were very close in interpretive, you know, tempos were similar, phrasing was similar, sound was the big thing because the harp sounded really different. And I remember that one from the standpoint of the one that really appealed to me was the one that was clean as a whistle. It was so clean. It was such a precise performance. It was just, and it turned out to be an American. The European recordings had more freedom. They had more joie de vivre, you know, but they weren't so clean and they weren't so pristine. And I don't know whether it was just when I was doing it or my stage of learning, but man, I loved that. And that's the one I picked. And then afterwards, he would tell me who they were. But yes, I think he made a conscious choice to try to get as wide a variety of harpists as he could.
I like that it was blind too, because otherwise I think it would change how you listen to things. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And this is going to take us back a little bit to something you had said a minute ago. I don't know this for sure, but my sense is that whether we're talking about kids in school or in sports or in music, there's a trend towards earlier specialization.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think there's some research on it, which we don't have to get into necessarily, but it sounds like your experience was that of not specializing quite so narrowly in the early going. And I'm curious if you have thoughts on whether that is still a useful way to approach our playing now or music in general now, or have things changed where early specialization makes sense, or I don't know. What are your thoughts on that?
I think it's a pendulum in every field. And I think that I grew up in an era when the general practitioner, the GP, the family doctor, I kind of grew up in that musical environment. You did a little bit of everything. You were good at a lot of different things and you didn't really specialize early on. You know, and then in medicine, for example, when people started defining specialties earlier and we ended up with a dearth of doctors who could serve rural communities and be a general practitioner, and then it swung back the other direction. And so I think useful, I don't know whether how I learned or how I grew up or how somebody who specialized earlier, I don't know whether it was useful. I know that all I know is that I think it becomes the context for our life, and that my sort of general education happened earlier and my specialized education later. But some people specialize earlier, and then later in life they go, wow, I really want to read, you know, all of the works of Descartes. I've never had a chance. I think I'll go read. You know, they, or I'd like to learn languages, because when I was specializing over here, I didn't get that chance. And I think it's more a question of when we do it, or that we do it at some point before we die, that we do both, that we are a generalist and a specialist in some way, because it makes us a complete human being. But I'm not sure timing-wise. I mean, I was definitely not funneled into being a specialist early on. And I remember there were two musicians in Minneapolis when I was growing up who were, and I was insanely jealous that they were doing things that I thought I could do, but I wasn't being encouraged to do. On the other hand, I think I didn't have the internal discipline to do them on my own.
Do you mean like repertoire or?
I do remember competitions. Okay. I would never complete a competition repertoire because there was always something, invariably something that I didn't like, right? In a division or in a set of competition repertoire. And so I wouldn't really do it. If it was a single thing, like a concerto competition or something, I would enter those and you know, usually did pretty well up against other instrumentalists. But if it was a harp competition and it had a set of repertoire, I would say, well, I'd start everything and I'd go, oh, these are great pieces, but this is terrible. So I would never finish. And I think if my mother had insisted that I finish, pushed me, I would have just said, no, I don't want to do it. I think she was doing a high wire act that now I appreciate.
Well, I was just going to say, it sounds like there's a really fine line that somehow mm-hmm. you guys both managed to navigate such that mm-hmm. you continued to play the harp.
Yeah. And I think there was, and I do think it was a real high wire act for both of us. I think every artist, every musician in this case, grows up in some kind of environment where there's that tension between all the practice and all the preparation and the time then that can't be devoted to doing other things. And for any parent of any child who's going to do something, I mean, you think about, you know, elite athletes, it's the same way. We never talked about the sacrifices. Maybe we should have, but it just wasn't an era when people talked about that stuff. You just kind of did what you were working on and went and did it. And maybe we should have had a conversation about, okay, we're going to do this and we can make this sacrifice, but it means that these things over here can't happen.
I remember hearing you say in one of those videos that something like, if I couldn't do it right the first time, I didn't want to do it at all, is I think what you said. And
yes.
I'm curious how that evolved into, or what that evolved into, that became more presumably functional and useful to you, and how that happened.
Let me think about that for a sec. And I think you need to contextualize the videos. I mean, I like that when I watched your videos. This is a public education channel, folks. It's nothing bad. I was apparently, even as a really young child, fiercely independent. And I wouldn't let anybody do anything for me, period. My father used to always say when I was a four-year-old, three-year-old, I would say, I do it myself. And I did. I just would push people away, and I still do that. You know, I bought this house and last week ago, 10 days ago, you know, and I thought, oh, great, there's only one step up the front porch. And I went out, got the harp, pulled it in, and I twisted my back for the first time in my life. And I thought, 5 hours later, lying on the floor, I thought, Lynn, you idiot. All you had to do, the neighbor was in the driveway. All you had to do was ask him to help. But I have trouble doing that, and I always have. So there are pitfalls in that, because if you try to do everything on your own, it's a form of procrastination in a sense, because if you can't do it perfectly, you get tied up with not doing it at all. So as a very young person, I was super critical of myself. If I couldn't get it, wasn't going to do it. And I think that my father's approach to me was to cajole me. My mother's was to say, go do something else and come back. And I think hers was the better approach, because she, as a teacher, instead of sitting there and trying to make me feel that it was okay to be so dismissive and stubborn and perfectionistic in that way, she would say, go do something else. Come back in 10 minutes. And I would. And of course, then I could do it. You know, it's like, ay, ay, ay. I think your question, how has that manifested itself?
Well, I guess I'm curious how you manage to, because a lot of times what will happen is if people are stuck in that sort of place, in that sort of relationship with perfectionism, they end up just not doing things. And so I was reading an article where they said there are not a lot of super highly perfectionistic perfectionists at the highest levels of things, because they tend to burn out and don't get there. And so that's why I was wondering how you got around that, or how you managed to handle it.
Well, I think it's been a stumbling block for me for almost my entire career, until I finally came up against a wall where I failed. I mean, big time. And came to understand that that kind of rigid perfectionism isn't realistic and isn't sustainable. And it was, you know, not recently, but it certainly wasn't in my 20s that this happened. But I failed spectacularly well, and in public. And I think a lot of people would say, oh, couldn't she have done that in the practice room? But I think for me, I had to do it in front of people to understand that I was just setting staggeringly unrealistic expectations for myself. And then, as a result, possibly passing those along to other people. And so that failure, when it happened, really helped me to understand that there are a lot of different ways to measure success and to measure accomplishment and to measure satisfaction. It's kind of a Zen thing. It just took me a long time to get there, longer than you would think. But I think that's what made the difference. And at that point you go, well, that was so bad. Nothing else I do could be any worse. So let's try being a little bit more creative, or a little bit more nurturing, kind to ourselves, better to ourselves in who we are. And, you know, this is nothing you're going to find on YouTube or in a newspaper or anything. It was just one of those nadirs that I think people have to have. And I think a lot of people have them, but they don't admit it. And they do come out the other side a different person. And I'm more than happy to say, yeah, I blew it big time. And I think in the end, it did change my approach. But for years, and as a young student, I mean, young up through 25, 26, I was, oh, if I couldn't do it the first time, I just thought there was no point in doing it.
And we're talking about a playing related disaster.
Oh, yeah. Oh, it was a stunner. It was a real stunner.
Did you know that was going to happen going into it, or did it just totally catch you by surprise? And
totally caught me by surprise. Yeah. I read the Peter C. Brown Make It Stick, mm-hmm. you know, and at your recommendation. And I thought it's a brilliant collection and compendium of ways of thinking. And he uses the phrase, the illusion of knowing. That was me. That was me. And I went into a performance going, oh, I've got this. This is, I'm going to be great. And it was a recital. So it wasn't like one piece. It was like the first piece went badly. And then I had to stay on stage and I had to keep going. And it just went from bad to worse in front of all these people. And I got my comeuppance, and I realized that it was my responsibility. I hadn't prepared right, properly. I had relied on that illusion of knowing that he, as he refers to it, oh, I can do this. I don't need to practice that. I can always get that part. Yeah. And I didn't. And so it did change me, and it changed how I taught. This was before my sort of teaching career started, that this happened. but it changed how I worked with students, because I think at that time, the teacher I had sort of bought into it too. She'd said, oh, you'll be great. Everything's fine. And everything was so far from being fine. And I had nothing to fall back on when it all started to fall in on itself. Had it been one piece on a recital where you could walk off stage and go, well, that was, you know, that was not my best effort. That would be one thing. But it was really the, you know, a full program where you had to keep going. I think it changes us. It is literally a ring of fire when something like that happens. And it was what I had to do to learn that I couldn't keep doing what I was doing. Like I said, for some people, it would be much less catastrophic, nuclear. It would be much less nuclear. And they would realize, oh, wait, I need to change how I'm thinking about my preparation or my context or my anything. And for me, it had to be in public and it had to be in front of a lot of people and it had to be a big moment.
There's two kind of quick things I wanted to make sure I understand, if it's okay. I'm trying to connect the dots between what you said you were doing that wasn't sustainable or that you couldn't continue to do and the perfectionism. Could you kind of connect those for me? Like how did this relate to the perfectionism?
Well, I think in me, being a perfectionist manifests itself in not wanting to do something at which you think you might fail, that you don't know. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
That if I'm faced with, if somebody asks me to do something that I need to do and I think I can't do it, I put off doing it. And then when I do it, it's like, oh, well, I could do that all along. Why did I wait? So in that sense, I think that, well, I don't know. I hate to talk about myself. This is hard. But I think at the time that I made this spectacular deep dive into failure, it was in part because I have always had an incredibly facile technique. I could just blaze my way around the harp. And I thought that that meant I knew what I was doing. So here I could play fast. I could play all these notes. I could do all these things. And I was in this environment and I had these pieces and I'd played them all before and I was going to play this recital. And so I figured that I knew how to do it, even though I was a new town. I was nervous about the audience. I understood that I was going to be on display. I didn't acknowledge those things. So the perfectionism manifested itself by saying, oh, you're just in your same environment. You're fine. You're going to be okay. And I never dealt with the fear of that would have helped me to sort of lit a fire under me to be more prepared in more ways. So I fell back on, oh, I've got this.
So it's almost like the perfectionism kind of led you to put this armor on to not mm-hmm. acknowledge the preparation yeah. that might have actually been necessary because it was a different situation, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah. Exactly. And I think that having done that, I realized, and so it took probably another 10 years for me to understand that my learning process was not very healthy. Not healthy. It wasn't durable. And I don't mean technical learning. It was the musical learning. And so I kind of changed how I approached over time. Took a lot of time. But you kind of change how you learn things. And so I started to learn things with a lot of safety mechanisms, a lot more safety mechanisms. Where am I going? What am I doing? How is this happening? What are my ways to get there? If my finger doesn't go where it's supposed to go, that's okay because my brain knows it. So then you start to do you write your music out. You start and stop at random, you know, all those things that I'd never done, never done, because I could play fast and everybody thought that was great. I just couldn't run off that stage fast enough.
And the other thing that I was really intrigued by, you said you ran the risk of passing it on to other people. I'm assuming you mean through teaching somehow, but how does that play out?
You know, this is going to... Well, take it at face value. I knew all my life that I wanted to be a teacher. I love teaching. I've loved the idea of it, and I've loved doing it. And I pull how I teach the harp from everybody but my major harp teachers. I had this ongoing tussle with my mother, so I knew I never wanted to be in that kind of teaching relationship where that sort of manifested itself. And my other two major teachers, one was extremely hands-off and dismissive. And so all I learned was to be afraid of whether I was going to fail. Had I practiced enough, not smart, not strategically, not knowingly, but had I just done enough? And then the third one was, this was a phrase that I found reading years ago. I was reading a medical journal, and they were talking about the role of the toxic mentor in how doctors or students choose residencies and choose specialties. And I think I had one of those. And so I knew when I started to teach that I really didn't. I wanted to teach all of the things I had learned about the instrument and about the technical delivery of the harp, but not in the way that I had been taught. And so I pulled all of my teaching from other influences, from other musicians, from reading instrumental biographies, from working with other musicians and seeing how they performed and seeing how they treated me in performance situations. And that's what I did with my students, or I hope that I did with my students. And I never pulled from my own instrumental educational background, but it was much more from other people. That's kind of weird.
It sounds like it mirrors a little bit your growing up with different influences that, yeah, that led to you being the kind of harpist that you became.
Yeah.
Except in teaching also.
Teaching is a real intimate act when you get right down to it. There's a level of trust that has to be established. And sometimes it's difficult to do that on either side. And sometimes when you break through that, it's almost too much. It's too emotional. It's too visceral. And so then you back off and you go, okay, we're going to go back to just doing what we were doing. But you hope that down the road, that student grows into their own potential, emotional potential. But you know that it's not the right time when they're in your room. You know, you hit that button, that nerve, it's a real nerve. You hit it and then you've just got to back away from it. So I don't know. I've just tried to draw inspiration from other musicians who were more joyful than I ever was, more patient, kind, thorough, you know, I don't know, all kinds of stuff. I think that teacher-student relationship and learning is just everything. It's everything. And no matter what we're doing, whether we're in book club or learning something new as an adult or nurturing a kid, it's fantastic.
For a full transcript of this episode, plus links to random interesting things that came up in conversation, as well as resources like practice hacks and the audition cheat sheet, please visit bulletproofmusician.com/blog.